Good morning, y'all. We're in the book of Esther. Chapter 1, we were there last time. We're going to be starting there and finishing part of chapter 2. Book of Esther has a lot of commentaries on our modern culture, modern situation, even though it's a book written about a situation that existed 2,500 years ago. Moral and cultural statement that is made here in the first couple of chapters is a good example of what happens to a culture, to a people, when God is not present. Or I should say God is present everywhere, but where God is not acknowledged, where God is not honored, where God is not known, where God is not feared. And we take for granted, or at least I do, common decency. Take for granted morals. We take for granted that people know right from wrong. Basically, we expect that in our culture, at least I do. Less and less, I guess, anymore, it seems. But nonetheless, we do. We look down our noses on cultures that do not have the same kind of norms that we have. We look down our noses at the Mexican culture south of us here. And honestly, it's a whole lot worse down there. I mean, the reason why people are dying to get over here is because it's bad over there. And the reason why we don't go down there is because it's bad down there. They do have it a lot worse than we have, but it is a mistake, a critical error, to think that we as Americans are superior in any way to Mexicans. Or another one we look down on is the Arab world. I mean, horrible atrocities, corruption, just culture completely unraveled. We look down our noses at these people and we say, we're better than them. And that is a huge, massive mistake. We think racially in the sense of the American race, and we're of all races here. But we think of the American race as better than the Mexican race or the Arab race or whatever, which is, like I said, an incredible error, an unbelievable error. We have it better here, but the reason is not because of who we are. We have it better here because God has been honored in our culture. His laws have been honored. His Bible has been honored and exalted in our culture. And for these reasons, and these reasons only, we have greater benefits. And as soon as we divorce ourselves fully from the God that has been blessing us, we will be just like them. We are no better, no different than them. People are people no matter where you go. Their cultures are not as good as ours. Their situations and nationalities are not as good as ours because God has not been known or honored in those places the way God has been known and honored in our culture. But don't think for the slightest second that we are in any way superior to them intrinsically. We are definitely, definitely not. When God goes out the window, all his blessings go out as well, and we will be left with the same that they have: depravity, cruelty, indecency, high order, just like they have in those countries. We're no different than them. We're no better than them. It's the blessings that we have as a culture come straight from God and straight from him only. So let's consider today, as I said, this commentary that we have here in the book of Esther on our own culture. What happens to a culture when God isn't named and when God isn't honored and when God goes out the window? Well, let's see what happens in this culture and see if we like it, because I bet we don't. Esther chapter 1, we left off last time with the king. Esther's doesn't even factor into the first chapter at all because she's not even on the stage. She doesn't even know any of these things are taking place. Probably knows there's a big party, but nonetheless. So the king in chapter 1 throws a gigantic party for 6 straight months. For 6 straight months, he demonstrates to the whole world his majesty, the world that he rules anyway. All the things that he has, he puts them on display. He exalts himself, and basically most historians believe he sells war. He's trying to pitch a battle against the Greeks to the west. They have more land than they can possibly rule, but nonetheless, he thinks they need to conquer more land to the west, so they're going to move into Greece. And so for 6 months, he sells war through this great party, this great gathering and feast, to his leaders, to his rulers, and to his generals and other people. And then to cap it all off, at the end of the 6-month party, he has a 7-day drinking binge with all the men in the capital city, roughly 50,000. So you got 50,000 snockered adult males in modern day Iran. At the end of that drinking binge, she makes a request. Look at verse 10. Chapter 1, it says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry, which simply means he was plowed under with wine, he commanded these seven guys, whose names I can't really pronounce, the seven eunuchs, it says, who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti, that would be his wife, before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and to the princes, for she was very beautiful. So, he's shown them everything that he's got for 6 months, save one thing, his wife. So what is she? Just one more thing that he's got, if you will. Just a possession. She gets the message. He makes a request of her. We're not told exactly what the terminology was, the exact specific request was, but notice her reply. Verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs, and the king became very angry, and his wrath, it says, burned within him. Many speculations as to what he was actually asking the queen to do. But let's just think together. There's no way to know for sure what he said, but we've had a 6-month party. We've had a 7-day all male drinking binge. At the end of that drinking binge, he makes a reasonable request of his wife. What do you think? Come on. This guy thinks he's God. Everyone there thinks he's God. Now that they're so drunk, they're convinced that he's God. And as God, he makes a request, probably unseemly, probably ridiculous. We don't really know. I would be willing to bet, though, that if it was reasonable, she would have done it. But you can think, ladies, come in and parade. If it was nothing more than come in and parade yourself in front of 50,000 drunken men, you would have said, no, thank you. But nonetheless, whatever it was, obviously people don't get liquored up and go out and do random acts of kindness, do they? They don't do that. So these guys are liquored up and they are making requests, probably not good. We don't know what it is, but nonetheless, it's unseemly at the very least. And so she refuses, and he makes a request that he shouldn't have made, and he forces her to take a stand that she didn't want to take, and yet nonetheless, it's done. All this is done in front of the whole capital city, all the men there, and now it's his pride and authority that are at stake, and so it's not going to go well. He thinks he's God. His authority has been questioned. He's in front of all the men of the city who think he's God. They've had 6 or 10 too many. How's this going to go? Queen Vashti. I would suggest to you, now, the way it goes is he divorces her. That's the edict. We're going to read that in just a second. He divorces her. I think it went pretty well for her, honestly. In that culture, under those situations, that she came away with her life was a good day, I think. But nonetheless, I'm just reading between the lines in it. It may not be accurate, but I think it's pretty close to it. Not surprising, though, that things go the way they do. Look at verse 16, skipping down. So he gets really mad because she doesn't come in and, I don't know, strut her stuff. And so he turns to his advisors and says, what should I do with this woman? And so this guy by the name of Memucan, it says there in verse 16, makes this his suggestion. Queen Vashti, he says, has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of Ahasuerus. That's his title. And the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. And this day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes. There will be plenty of contempt and anger. In other words, you're going to cause a lot of problems in a lot of homes if you don't fix this. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of the Persian Media so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of King Ahasuerus. In other words, divorce gives her the boot. And let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she, and then the king edict, and when the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard throughout all the kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small, and the word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. You've got to wonder about this guy, Memucan. I wonder if he didn't have ulterior, you know, if this ever gets back to the old lady, I got to do something. You know, life's going to be really rough. You got to wonder about the guy. But here you have a male-dominated society, liquored up, requesting who knows what of the leading lady, if you will. And no one raises an eyebrow. Because, you know why? Because this is the way it is in cultures that do not know God. Let me just say this to you, ladies. You are our equals, that is, of males, in every way. Superior in most ways. Certainly better looking. Certainly. Better smelling, better acting, smarter, more capable. That's the way it is in my home. Mine is all those things and more so. But let me just say this to you very carefully and very solemnly. You are not our equals physically. We are bigger and meaner than you. We will always be. So I say that, I mean, that's obvious. Typical male in here is twice the size of the typical female in this place, right? I mean, there is a difference in the sexes, is there not? I know the whole world is saying, and I'm just thinking, do these people, either they're one, they're not married, or they haven't had children of both sexes. To say that they're the same is just beyond me. But anyway, hear me carefully, ladies, girls, because this is where we're headed as a culture. Dread the day that this culture forgets God, because you will be the first to pay the price. If there is no God ruling the hearts of men or deciding the morals of men in any culture, you're the first ones to catch it, because you're the weakest. It's just the way it is. Just the way it is. What you see here in this culture, we oh my goodness, how horrible this could be, but I'm telling you, there's plenty of cultures today that are not far from this. Like I said, 9 miles south of here, try it. The Arab world, try it. A large percentage of the population of the world, women live under stuff like this. We've had great privilege here. All of us have. It's not because we're Americans, guys. It's because God has been predominant here. His rules, His laws, His word. He has been honored in our culture. For that reason, everyone has freedom. But as soon as God is out the window, like I said, the weaker among us are going to be the first to pay. When God is left out, that is exactly what happens. The vulnerable and the weak are the first to suffer. That's the reason why God sets up two classes of individuals in the Old Testament and the New as specific barometers of the if you will, the health of a culture. Those two individuals, or those two classes of within a culture, are namely orphans and widows. Look at what it says several places. You could go to a bunch of places in the Old Testament. It's like God continues to repeat this over and over again, at the importance of this. Speaking of himself, he says, a father, he says, I'm a father to the fatherless. The defender of the widows is God in his holy dwelling. He could have named him. Is he not the God? Is he not the father to all of us? Is he not the God and the defender of all of us? But why does he take these two people, these two groups out? Because they're a barometer. They're a canary in the cage to the health of a culture. If these two are doing well in a culture, then you can be pretty sure that you'll do well. If these two are not protected in a culture, bets are off. Bets are off for sure. Again, this is repeated over and over again in the scriptures. Deuteronomy 24:17. Do not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of a widow as a pledge. Why? Because he's specifically concerned about them. They are weak. They are vulnerable. And he sets it up as a barometer, as a test to the condition of a culture. Again, you have it in James, the one maybe we're most familiar with. Religion that our God, our Father, accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after, again, there it is, orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Why does he point these out? Because it's indicative of the health of a culture. If a culture is healthy, that is, a culture is God is honored, God is known, then these are going to be okay. But if these aren't okay, then you immediately know the condition of the culture. And I will say this, even though we have, ladies, you have great freedom here, and I wished it would stay, but I'm telling you, as we divorce ourselves from God, watch out. Just watch out. It's not going to be good. And it's interesting that the women's livers movement that's out there, and I'm a women's liver. I'm all about women's lib. I think women should get everything that they deserve. They're smarter, better looking, better smelling than most men that I know, more capable than most. Pay them better. I don't care. I love that. I think it's great. But I'm saying, but the typical women liver out there are also anti-God. And I'm just thinking, do you not understand? Do you not see how big we are? God is the only thing holding men back. And if you take God out of our hearts, ladies, you're in trouble. Big trouble. So in this culture, ladies meant nothing, as we're going to see. Rejecting God, it leads to a sick society. And that's what you have here in the book of Esther. You have a sick society. Turn with me to chapter. You're in chapter 2. Turn there. Take a look. Chapter, verse 1. Look at, it gets worse. He asks his wife to do unseemly things, his own wife, in front of 50,000 men. It's going to get worse. It says that after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what he had decreed against her. He divorced her. The king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king." In other words, let's find yourself a wife. "And let the king appoint overseers of all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa, the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai," it says, "the king's eunuch who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them." In other words, let them undergo beauty treatments. "And then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in the place of Vashti." Seems reasonable. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Seems reasonable until you know the whole story. But let me give you some background just to let you know where we are. Chapter 1, you have King Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, selling war. Well, he sells it. Chapter 2 is 4 years later. There's a 4-year gap between chapters 1 and chapter 2. He sold war in chapter 1. Between chapters 1 and chapter 2, he has inaugurated war twice. There's been 2 campaigns of the Persians into the west against the Greek. And guess what happened? No bueno. He did not win. The undefeatable Persians have been defeated twice against a much smaller, and by many respects, less equipped Greek army, but they had a very smart general by the name of Alexander the Great. And so basically the Persians have seen the beginning of the end of their culture because Greek is about to just wipe them completely out. So King Ahasuerus has come back to the capital city defeated, come back with a lot of regret. "I should have just kept the property and not gone into the west. I should have kept my wife." I mean, he's really upset. "What do I do?" And so his lackeys come around and say, "Why don't you just build a new harem? What could make the king more happy than getting a couple hundred more wives, right?" And so that's what they do. We're not going to read the whole story, but I'm not going to varnish it up for you. I'm going to tell you exactly how it went. What they did was they collected, either by will or by force, the best-looking virgins from his realm, which was everything from India all the way down to Ethiopia and all the way west into Turkey. Virgins, by the way, read also teenagers, in case you want to know, because every woman by the age of 20 for sure was married by this time. So you're looking at 15 to 18 year old girls. This is Esther's age. 15 to 18 year. He gathers up a bunch of teenagers, may have been your daughter if you'd lived back then, brings them in a force of, according to Josephus, who was a historian that wrote later, but wrote about this time. He said it was over 400 of these teenagers that he gathered into his harem. Each one of them went through these cosmetic treatments, and then he, the king, slept with every one of them night after night for over a year and a half. That's what happened. Like I said, I'm not going to varnish it for you, because that's exactly what took place here. They went and spent the night with the king, and it wasn't a night of deep conversation. Let's just say that. It was not. This was acceptable. So the king basically is a pervert and sleeps with all the good-looking teenagers in his whole realm. Wow. Is that what you want? How'd you like to live in a place like that? Notice no eyebrows are raised. I mean, this is what is suggested. Nobody complains. They just go through with it because it was the culture, just the way it was. This is what happens when a culture divorces itself and knows nothing about God. This is the kind of things that happen. Like I said, the weak are the most susceptible. The weak are the first ones they're going to pay. And so that's exactly what happens. And we think, well, back then people were messed up. I mean, this was a long time ago. We've evolved since then. Oh my goodness, have we really? You know, I find that culture has changed. I find that we've changed the technology, but I've not found that people are any different. I just think for a second. South of us, 9 miles, is Mexico, ruled for the most part by drug lords. The whole thing. Do you suppose that these guys with all this money and all this power and all these murders underneath their belt are also living a monogamous relationship with their wives? You suppose women have it real good with them? Yeah. What about the Arab world where women, and by the way, the same area right here that we're talking about is the Arab world now. The Arab world where women are really nothing more than they were then. Property. You suppose the Arab man is faithful, monogamous relationship with his wife? Really? You really think that? I don't think so. What about Vladimir Putin? You know that guy? Nice guy. Holds the strings, by the way, to more than half the world's nuclear arsenal. Answers to no one. Suppose he's living in a monogamous relationship with his wife. Doesn't indulge at all. Right? We're no different. There is no difference. We've changed cultures. We've changed languages. We've changed religions. But when God is not present, when God is not feared, the same things happen over and over again. It's just no different. We're no better. And again, we look and we say, oh, how horrible this is and how incredibly sick and repulsive it is. But our society is not far from this. We never are. Rejecting God and His ways and His plans turns us into no better. Just think, I mean, just the microcultures that have arisen within our quote-unquote superior American race. The microcultures, as an example. Remember David Koresh, 1991, 1990? Remember what he did? This is in Texas. I mean, we're not talking about America. We're talking about Texas, guys. The real Americans, right? This guy's born and bred in Houston. Invents this cult, which, by the way, you always know a man invents it when he winds up sleeping with all the women in the cult. A man invented that thing. No different than the Mormons, by the way. This is 200 years ago. Invented a similar cult where they just got to marry a whole bunch of women, but it was the same thing. You get to marry these young girls, do the same thing that this guy's doing. This is an American culture going on here. And then, of course, you've got, what was the guy's name, Warren Jeffries? The fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. A weirdo up there. Again, what was he doing? Sleeping with virgins, just like this guy was doing. We're no different. This is America. Our cultures and our norms are different, and supposedly, right? But as soon as God goes, so goes all those blessings. Go right out the window. All those things. And so I've told you all this just simply so that you can feel the same way I do. Depressed. I don't like any of it. What do we do? I mean, what do we do? Honestly, we sit around and we see our culture dissolve. And it's dissolving, you know, and you know, should I be concerned about our culture? No. Should I be concerned about the people of my culture because they're turning their back on God? Yes. What do we do? Polls demonstrate, here, this is an interesting poll already recently, and I think you're going to find it interesting, that only 13% of the American population hold to evangelical Christian practices. I'm not saying 13% are evangelical Christians. I'm saying 13% hold to evangelical Christian practices. I'm hoping there's a lot more Christians than that. But I'm just saying there's only 13% that actually live their lives like the Bible says we should live our lives. Morally, honestly, only 13%. Ever felt like the minority? There's a reason for it. You are. Me too. No one here, or maybe you do, I don't know, but I don't think you do, considers themselves to be radical fundamentalist Christians, do you? A radical fundamentalist Christian, is that what you consider yourself to be? Me neither. But I want you to know that the world, the culture you're living in, more and more considers you and I to be those very things. because of the principles we hold to. Principles that were, 50 years ago, the mainstream. It was the norm. It was the culture. Truly, it was. It was to be expected. But now we've become segregated and marginalized and placed into a corner that now we're considered fundamental, radical. And we're just trying to do the same thing we've been trying to do, which is do what this says. What's happened to us? What do we do? I mean, what do? Stockpile weapons? You know, kind of like that. Build a compound? Hide ourselves? Segregate ourselves? They're going to segregate us, so we're going to truly segregate. We're going to hide ourselves far away. Is that what we do? Is that what Jesus called us to do? Far from that. Probably the worst thing we could do is withdraw from our culture. I mean, it's shocking and appalling the steps downward that our culture has made, but we shouldn't be shocked or appalled because that's what sinners do. Sinners sin. Lost people act like lost people. People that don't know God make decisions and go in directions that demonstrate that they don't know God. There should be a part of this that we expect. As our culture gets away from God, we should expect that that's the way they act. We should expect that they marginalize those who don't go with them, like us. We get very religiously segregational because our world is getting seemingly dumber and unable to make good decisions, unable to put in positions of leadership those who can make good decisions. And we want to segregate ourselves off from them and say, I'm getting away from this heartless, ruthless, becoming more oblivious world. But there is a reason why, again, they're acting this way. The reason why they act this way, guys, is because they do not know God. It's real simple. They act like they don't know God because they don't know God. They don't know Him. And that's why they act that way. That's why they act that way. Sinners are going to sin. That's what they do. That's what they know. That's their life. But Jesus has left us here literally to mix with sinners. Did you know that? Look at what He says. You are the salt of the earth. What good is salt inside of a salt shaker? You're going to segregate yourself? I know you're not building a compound. Maybe you're collecting a few firearms, right? But you're not building a compound. But if you build a compound emotionally around yourself where the world just is over there, that's the salt inside of a salt shaker. Salt's got to get out. Salt is preservative. It doesn't say that we are some of the salt. It says we are the salt. We're the only preservative that God has placed into this world to stop the putrefaction of peoples and cultures. You and I, the radical fundamentalists. Salt of the earth, He says, you are the light of the world. No, He doesn't say you're some of the light. He says you're it. There is either darkness or there is you. And notice what He says about the light. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl, He says. But who lit the lamp called you and me? Who lit that lamp? You did? No, Jesus did, didn't He? So He's the lamp lighter. He's the light giver. He's the lamp lighter. He's also the light placer. Instead, it says, they put it on a stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. You see, you see this. These are the words of Jesus Himself. He says, you're the light of the world. He said, it doesn't say you might be or could be. Are there others like you? He says, you are it. And also, those who light a lamp, He says, is by way of illustration. Those who light a lamp don't light a lamp and hide it. They light a lamp and put it up where it can be seen. He's speaking of not your function, but His. Not to say that you shouldn't try to shine or you shouldn't try to be, but He's telling you, I'm the light lamp, the lamp lighter, and I'm the lamp placer. I'm the one who sets the ones where I want them to be in the places to give. Have you ever thought about your life that way? I've been placed in the place where I am so that I can give light. I've been placed in the place where I am so that the salt that Jesus has made me be can be the preservative that it's supposed to be in this given situation, this given circumstance. By the way, just back to our story, that is the story of Esther. She was and her uncle, or actually her cousin, they were it as far as God-fearing people in this culture. No one else. They were talk about radical, marginalized fundamentalists. They were the only two of millions. They were the only two. And they were hiding. They had built their little compound. Mordecai tells Esther, don't tell them you're a Jew, right? They find out later. Because she has to come out. Because her people are at stake. But God takes her as a light and places her in the specific place that he wants her to be. And God's not asking you to be a queen. Maybe he is. But I will tell you this, he's asking you to be a light. Where has he put you? It's not just happenstance, the job that you have, the circumstances you have, the family that you're in, or situation, the neighborhood you live. It's not happenstance. Because Jesus is the lighter of the lamp and the placer, as I read it, of the lamp also. So where has he placed you? And what are you doing there? I said, salt shaker inside of a bottle? Mm-mm. It's got to get out. The lamp under a bowl? Bowl's got to be turned over. He's placed you in places where you can do what only you can do. Say, oh, preacher, you don't know me. No, I don't. But I do know myself. I know my weaknesses, and I know how you feel. You feel incapable. You feel overwhelmed. That's the way I feel. You feel like the whole world's against you. And, you know, I just told you, pretty much is. But God has called you to be a hero in that situation, in your family, in your job, in your circumstances in school, in your situation, wherever he has placed you, he's called you to be the hero there. Some heroes go down with the ship. Some heroes win. Both are heroes. I want to ask if you would bow your heads and close your eyes with me. And I want you to think real specifically about your own situation where God has placed you. Salt and light. Salt and light, to be a preservative, to be something that sheds light on the truth wherever you are. I'm not saying that you need to stand up with your Bible on a chair and yell and tell everybody that they're wrong and all that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying be who you're supposed to be in that place, that you mix with them, but you're not like them. You stand next to them, but you live a different way. You make different decisions. You believe in different stuff, and it's not just a matter of something you believe privately. It is what you are. Our world needs that. They need that. 13% of our world hold to evangelical principles, but I'd be willing to bet there's way more than 13% that actually are evangelicals, truly are Christians. But we're just hiding. We're just mixing. We're just falling in and acting just like them. Something's got to change. Our world needs us. Our God has commanded us to be something different. Heavenly Father, I thank you for making us salt, for making us light. Forgive us, God, where we have failed in that responsibility, where we have kept the salt in the salt shaker, where we have kept a bowl over the light. We've done that either by hiding ourselves away or by acting so much like the world that the world doesn't know there's any difference from us. But we are different. You've made us different. We follow a different shepherd, a different master. We belong to a different ruler. God, I pray that what is in us would come out of us. The light that we are would be the light that is seen. Or we look at our culture and we see how it is going downhill and we see the demonstration of that all around us, and we're no different than them. We experience your blessings only because we have been faithful to you to a degree. But as we lose our faithfulness, so we lose our blessings and we lose our culture. Lord, I pray that regardless of where culture goes, that we would stand and be who we're supposed to be. And we let the chips fall where they may. Thank you so much, God, for the convicting word that we get from this story. The scary situation that we see, and yet the brightness that we see of a person like Esther and her cousin standing up and being what they can be in whatever circumstances you place them in. Help us to be the same kind of people, God, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen.